listen to the Quran. The second step, learn the names of Allah. The third step, write the names of Allah. You're becoming familiar. You're making it.
But, sorry to interrupt
Take
you.
It step by step. Learn the prayer on the side, but don't push it.
Okay, you know, what's the thing? The thing is, like, imagine there are many girls out there, maybe even teenagers, or even older than that, and they would say that, okay, what's the problem with beauty? Is there any problem with beauty in all these surgeries?
The problem isn't the teenagers. The problem is their mothers. I know women who, they wear hijab, they do their prayers, they do everything, but they themselves are vain. And then they're complaining that their daughters are not wearing hijab. Right? Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is you. You are looking, why are you caring that your daughter's not wearing hijab? Is it because of Allah? Is it because of your daughter's morality? Or is it because people are looking? The truth is that it's the people. Because in the speech, it comes out. My husband's family all wear hijab. That's why. So your daughter is rebelling. She's following your example. So yes, you wear hijab, but your energy is not aligned with Allah.
So I was wrong all this time and I want to fix it as a mother. How can I?
Change yourself. Turn back. I'm a mother. I had to see a lot of hard things, not because of me, because of the extended family, right? Mm-hmm. The Holy Prophet said that, beware where you put your seed, because a woman's children will be like her brother and sister.
Very true.
So it's not just us and being, you know, we have to go into the tree of life to fix it. You can't do that. You won't understand what it is unless you're connected to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt and you're doing it regularly. That is a woman's job. She doesn't have any duty when it comes to finances. You're doing it for yourself. You're doing it because you want bigger houses, you want better cars, you want a better cell phone, you want more jewelry, you want this and that. Yes, you are. You're saying you find excuses, but it's also because they don't know, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's because that the people who are teaching Islam are not going to the core and root of the issue. We need to go to the spirit, change our living, and children follow us. If we're looking back constantly at the children, we're like a dog following his tail. You're turning back.
Exactly.
It's just like going after the dunya. The dunya is not forward. Allah is forward. The path to the zuhur is forward. And if you're not following that way, you're going to have every problem under the sun.
So you mean that we shouldn't look things at the very apparent surface?
That is the diagnostic. It's a symptom. It's a symptom of the smoke. It's a smoke of the fire that's burning underneath. Mm-hmm. You know, too many mothers or fathers, but I'm talking about mothers now, are satisfied when their children, for example, have a university degree, they wear hijab, they look like everything's wrong. And then the next generation, you're going to see the problem. The next generation. What kind of problem is it going to be? Autism? Schizophrenia?
Depression, perhaps?
Blindness? Blindness. These days, blindness is the next generation. Because we've had the emotional problems, the mental issues. The next is going to be physical. If you're blind, Allah says, in this world, spiritually blind in this world, I'll raise you blind. But the genetics follows the process too. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not going forward, you are going back. And the next generation is going to have to fix our mistakes.
To pay back for it.
We're here only for one thing, to evolve.
Exactly. That's very true. So if you're a student into university and then you have these peer pressure at a schools, or even if you have that pressure in your at your workplace, I guess the best and the foremost thing you have to do is to be educated for your thinking and for the perspective that you have. And all that you have to care about is not your outer beauty, but the inner beauty. And that inner beauty does not come unless you start to note and recognize what is your worth, and not to look at things in the vain way, and even if it is the trending thing and the comment.
I want to say a very important thing, because this might be a problem with the youth. I noticed that when I put on my hijab, it made me, in the men's eyes, more attractive, because I would walk down the street and be approached by men who were not even Muslim. So it's not about me. It's about, men don't go after the physical, especially now. Women think they do, but that's only very temporary.
Very temporary,
Today, they want authenticity.
Yeah.
Women have to be authentic, and then the whole world will look at them because it's unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, look at yourself as a diamond, and the beauty and the worth of a diamond is not in the shape and in the physical appearance. The worth is inside of this stone. So this was all for today. I hope you have enjoyed this. Until another episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear ladies.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
good night to all listeners of Iran Radio. This is Tehran, the Iranian capital, and I'm Asma, your presenter for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with our varied radio productions feature. That will be followed by Insight into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis or explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. And we round up this hour's programs with Islamic laws. The program focuses on Islamic laws and adopts a practical approach to the subject. Stay with us for the next hour.
Nature never ceases to amaze us. In the northwest of Isfahan, near the city of Alavije, hidden beneath a lone mountain, lies a mysterious cave called Sangris or Rockville. You can't see the entrance of the cave from afar as you climb, since it's like the entrance of a well, going deep down into the heart of the Alavije mountain. It might look difficult and somewhat scary at first, but it gets easier as you go further inside and get used to the new atmosphere. After all, caves are simply large underground rooms that are beautifully decorated by nature's hand. It's very eerie in here, and since there's no real lighting, it feels like a real adventure, like you're discovering the cave for the very first time. Limestone is one of the softest materials in the world, and as soon as it comes into contact with water, it dissolves. As droplets seep into caverns, they emit carbon dioxide, and when that evaporates, it leaves a bit of calcite on the ceiling. Calcite is essentially crystal in the form of limestone. As the process continues, more calcite is left behind, creating breathtaking formations known as stalactites and stalagmites. But this doesn't happen overnight. In fact, they grow at a very slow 16 cubic centimeters every 120 years, so such big columns can take millions of years to form.
Okay, our guides have told us that there are about 6 or 7 small caverns in this cave. We've checked out some of them. We're going to try and look at all of them, but I'm sure there's more, because on our way, we saw a couple of holes in the walls and in the ceiling, and you can't enter them without being fully equipped, so I don't think anyone's tried anyway. We can't go there, but I'm sure there's more.
Visiting this cave makes you feel like you're one of the characters in Jules Verne's science fiction novel, Journey to the Center of the Earth. But the thing is that this cave isn't a part of some fairy tale world. It's real, and it can be found right here near the city of Alavije. This cave was nature made, but from all the water related wonders engineers gifted to the world, to us all, perhaps the greatest luxury is indeed fresh and clean running water. Persian aqueducts, or qanats in Farsi, had a simple structure and were graded so ingeniously that gravity did all the work, bringing water up from under our feet to counties and towns without the need for fossil fuel or electric pumps. We've come to the historic city of Ardistan, that's 110 kilometers to the northeast of Isfahan, to show you two of the many aqueducts in Iran. The Arune aqueduct is said to be 2,500 years old. Such aqueducts move tens of thousands of liters of water, filtering them naturally along the way until they reached their point of division. Aqueducts are tunnels dug deep in the foothills of mountains with many shafts along their path. With a steady slope along the way, they directed water into populated areas. The challenge for engineers was to keep the water flowing at the same speed throughout its journey. They were mostly engineered in the same way, but you can still find exceptions if you look hard enough. The Moon Aqueduct has two horizontal canals. They are 4 kilometers apart and parallel to one another. The mother well of this aqueduct is 31 meters deep, and in total it has 30 shafts. In those days, although water was abundant, with the use of these ingenious underground structures in dry regions, people still made sure that none of it was put to waste.
This ancient water clock is known among the locals as Peng. It was used on a daily basis to ensure the fair division of irrigation water to the different fields of the village. Usually, one of the trusted elders of the village was in charge of the water clock, and he's known as the Mirab in the local dialect.
The locals had divided the 24 hours into pengs. The copper peng that has a small hole at its bottom was placed in a bigger bowl filled with water. The peng would gradually fill with water and would finally sink, hitting the big bowl and making a sound. At this point, the Mirab would empty it and repeat the process. After doing this for a number of times, the water path to one field was closed and another was opened. This process was repeated throughout the 24 hours by the Mirab to water the fields. The building in which the Mirab did his work was known as Pengkhane, the Peng House. Only three of the many Peng Houses of Najafabad have managed to survive the course of time and have now been restored. This is Golnar Farnoodi for Iran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, we have reached the ninth verse of this surah, Surah Ankabut. So let's listen to this verse, and we'll be right back with our discussion regarding it.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ.
And those who believe and do righteous deeds, we will surely admit them among the righteous into paradise.
So, as you listen to the verse, you might be familiar with some of the terminologies used in it because they have been repeated in the Holy Quran many times. وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ. And those who believe and do righteous deeds, certainly we shall admit them among the righteous. So, we stated and discussed this fact formerly about those who have faith and do righteous deeds. And this is repeated and emphasized again in this verse. So, it says, and those who believe and do righteous deeds, we certainly shall admit them among the righteous. Now, one question that may be asked regarding this verse is upon the purpose of the repetition of this meaning. Some commentators, regarding this meaning, I mean, believing and doing righteous deeds, have said that when this concept was mentioned in the former verses, it pointed to those who pave the path of the truth. But this verse, when it says, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ, it is pointing to those who are the guides of this path and are as signs to the way of monotheism. Since the application of salihin or righteous is mentioned about many of the prophets, those who asked Allah to join them to the righteous ones. So, this is one probability. I mean, one of the reasons that commentary is mentioned. But other commentators have said that this is also probable, that in former verses, the words were about the forgiveness of sins and good rewards for this group of believers. But here, in the ninth verse, where it says, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ, their high rank is referred to, which is صالحين, the righteous ones, which itself is another reward for them. So, they will be set in the row of both the righteous and the divine prophets and truthful ones and the martyrs, and they will keep company with them. Dear listeners, let us have a break and we'll be back with the rest of our conversation. So, as you were with us, we were discussing the concepts of iman and amal salih, belief and doing righteous deeds. And we said that these concepts are always together when in the Holy Quran they are mentioned and brought up. But here, another thing has been mentioned. Because in the seventh verse, it was mentioned, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَنُكَفِّرَنَّ عَنْهُمْ سَيِّئَاتِهِمْ. We will certainly acquit them of their bad deeds. But here it says, لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ. We will certainly admit them among the righteous. Some commentators in this regard, such as the author of Tafsir al-Mizan, Allama Tabatabai, says that the purpose of the believers mentioned in this verse regarding the previous verse means the children who, under the command of parents, are invited to polytheism, that if they persist for protection of their faith, they will become vagrant from their house and region, though being far from parents is difficult for them. On hereafter day, Allah will admit them among the righteous. So, actually what has been done in Tafsir al-Mizan is that this verse has been actually observed as a continuation of the previous sentence, where the Almighty Allah actually recommended the believers to be careful about their treatments with their parents and actually emphasized on this fact very much. So when the previous verse says that actually if do goodness to your parents, وَوَصَيْنَا الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ حُسْنًا, and we actually told man to do goodness unto his parents, but if they strive with you, وَإِنْ جَاهَدَاكَ لِتُشْرِكَ بِمَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٍ, that you associate with me somebody or something which you do not have the knowledge of, you are not to obey them. This means that this is a very hard and tough test and trial for the humankind to do. That's why another specific kind of reward for this act is mentioned. لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ. For sure, we will definitely admit them among the righteous. With so many different forms of emphasis, this actually verse says that we will admit them among the righteous. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, and that's when faith begins. Swing across the seven skies, see a pure heart never lies. The words you learn will never earn. It's time to think and wonder why. Stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God's in control is what I found. I think I'll try this time around. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The pleasure is all mine. Well, we have started discussing some of the jurisprudential laws related to medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei from a couple of episodes ago onwards. And we'd like to continue along the same line. And I'd like to ask you this question first at the beginning of this episode, Sheikh Javid. What's the general law, jurisprudential law, in the matter of abortion itself? Is this ruling or the ruling different if keeping the baby poses a danger to the mother's life? Which one's life is more important, the mother's or the baby? Because there might be a danger actually posed to the baby's life, and also we have another situation where the mother is endangered.
Of course, it's always the life of the mother that is more important in such cases. And of course, the fetus, which has not yet become alive and soul has not been infused to the fetus, is not important compared to the mother's life, mm-hmm. of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, coming to your question, aborting the fetus, as we said, is forbidden according to Islamic Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
The Islamic Sharia does not allow abortion under any circumstances, except for a few exceptions, which I will mention. It is not permissible under any circumstances to have an abortion, except I'm giving the exceptions, mentioning the exceptions, except when pregnancy poses danger to the mother's life. And in this case, of course, there's no objection to terminating the pregnancy before the soul has entered the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
And if this spirit or the soul enter the fetus, it is not permissible to abort it, even if the pregnancy spells danger to the mother's life. That's not permissible. So the fetus is alive, the soul has entered it. It may pose danger to the mother's life. Even if it poses danger to the mother's life, it is not permissible to have abortion. Of course, there are some medical solutions to it. Maybe the fetus may be pulled out and placed in an incubator. I think it's there's a machine in which the premature children are placed.
Yeah.
So there are other solutions possibly, but it's not permissible to have abortion even if it spells danger to the mother's life. Of course, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that In the event that carrying on with the pregnancy could prove fatal to both the fetus and the mother,
mm-hmm.
and there is no way to save the baby's life, but it is possible to save the mother's life through abortion, in that case, it is permissible to have abortion.
Mm, I see. Thank you very
much. Because the life of the mother is more important.
Yes, exactly. But thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Let me go straight, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws concerning the medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh, there is a mother who has aborted her 7-month-old illegitimately conceived fetus at the request of the father. Should blood money be paid, first of all? Assuming that it's a must, who should pay it? In other words, the mother or the father? How much is the blood money nowadays according to Ayatollah Khamenei?
As we discussed this issue a little bit in one way or the other in the previous episodes, it is absolutely forbidden to abort the fetus even if it was conceived due to adultery. So now here we say that adultery does not become a license for having abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, adultery is absolutely forbidden.
Yes,
but if a child is conceived, it's not permissible for either the wife or the husband to opt for abortion. The request of the father actually does not justify the action. The wife should not accept such a request, and it should not become a license. Also, the woman should bear the blood money if she had taken the initiative to abort the fetus, because she accepted the request, and of course the request, for example, was from the husband.
Mm-hmm.
But who was involved in the abortion? It is supposedly the wife who took the initiative to abort the fetus, and she performed the action that resulted in the abortion of the child. Now, as for the amount of the blood money, of course, it is doubtful in the given case. You know, as a matter of ihtiyat or caution, a settlement should be reached. You know, that the person who was involved in the abortion and the owner of the blood money should come to a settlement, a solution, and see how much they can compromise on this issue. And
Who should be compromised?
The two parties, okay, uh-huh. The ones who should inherit the blood money, and the one who was involved in the abortion,
directly or indirectly?
Directly, because the one who's indirectly involved is not to blame. Of course, in this case, he doesn't have to pay any blood money. Only that person who was directly involved, maybe the doctor, maybe the wife.
But normally the doctors, don't do that.
Normally that, of course.
So who should pay the blood money if the doctors aren't?
The doctors are liable, the doctors are responsible, and the one, if it was the doctor has to pay the blood money. Because no, it's not permissible, it's none of the doctor's business to accept such thing. and the doctor can choose not to accept carrying out the operation and terminating the pregnancy. If he does accept, then it is he who should pay the blood money. Now,
even if the parents actually ask him or her to do so,
he will not terminate the pregnancy without either the wife or the mother or the husband asking him to terminate the pregnancy.
Right.
I think it is it's something the doctor has to be held responsible for, and he has to give the blood money. And the amount of blood money is something that's doubtful, because it's not definite. It depends on the month or the age of the pregnancy and so on and so forth.
Okay, I have a relevant question, but we have to actually postpone it to after the break. So stay with us to hear that question. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shaykh Chavid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Shaykh Chavid. Shaykh Chavid, I have a relevant question, or a question related to the previous question that I asked just before the break regarding the amount of the blood money. And you said in an answer to my previous question that it depends on the age of the fetus, right?
Sure.
So how much is the blood money, for example, for deliberately aborting a fetus of 2.5 months? And to whom should it be paid?
Well, if it is a clot-like structure, the amount of blood money is 40 dinars. Now, we should see how much is a dinar in terms of dollar, or maybe the Iran currency or any other currency in this time and age. And if it is a flesh-like structure, it becomes 60 dinars. But when the fetus enters into the stage of a bone, but without the flesh, the blood money is 80 dinars. The blood money should be paid, of course, to the inheritors of the fetus, taking into consideration the classes of inheritors, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There are different classes of inheritors. Okay, the closest ones to the fetus should get the blood money. The person to whom the action of aborting is attributed, of course, must be denied a share in the inheritance, because he is or she is supposed to be the killer, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the killer is not entitled to inheritance based on the solid and very authentic tradition that is there in our religious sources.
I see. Okay. Under the advice of the doctor treating her, a pregnant woman found it necessary to have an operation for her gums and teeth. Is it permissible for her to have an abortion on the grounds that an anesthesia and an x-ray are going to deform the fetus?
First of all, I think it's not permissible for the wife, to treat her gums with such medicine that will deform the pregnancy or the child, the fetus. If there is a strong likelihood that it might cause such a problem. But of course, it is mentioned in the reason is mentioned in the question, and that reason is not valid for terminating the pregnancy. Of course, it's not permissible to have any kind of anesthesia for the x-ray, which would lead to deform the fetus. Even if it is used, then it's not permissible to have abortion for that very reason, which is believed to be invalid, of course.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Shavit. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, Sheikh Jawid, the guest speaker, and the rest of the crew, we wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You're tuned in to Iran Radio, coming to you from Tehran, and I'm Asma, your host for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a radio productions feature. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. After that, we have Around the World with reporters. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and far. Our varied radio productions feature will be next. And our final program this hour is A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Stay with us for the next hour.
Could believe fish falling from the sky, or frogs for that matter. These events sound more like scenes from a science fiction movie than actual news. Even if we weren't living in an age of fake news, accepting such stories would still be difficult. Yet some seemingly impossible phenomena are real. Rainfalls of fish and frogs do occasionally occur in certain parts of the world. The cause of this strange phenomenon is rare storms. Storms powerful enough to lift aquatic creatures from the sea into the sky and drop them back down over land. In 2018, the company Cambridge Analytica found itself at the center of a major scandal. The controversy dated back 2 years before the election, to to a time when Facebook had managed to collect data from thousands of users. These data sets were part of users' private information, yet they were secretly handed over to Cambridge Analytica. The data even included details about users' friends, and the company ultimately gained access to information from over 50 million individuals.
We think that the only personal information they have about us is what we've given them. And we think we can exert some control over what we give them. And therefore, we think that our calculation, our trade-off here, is something that is somehow under our control, that we understand.
Behavioral economics was an approach that extended its influence into other domains. If it could be used to change a president, then other tasks, like marketing and selling a product, were also possible. Marketers showed interest in this approach. They monitored people's behavior, analyzed it, and based on the results, took action to, for example, increase the sales of a product. This approach was a form of surveillance-based market, which transformed the way products were sold.
I can see how people with these characteristics typically behave over time, and that allows me to fit your data right into that arc and to predict what you're likely to do, not only now, but soon and later. This is what I call behavioral surplus, these data streams filled with these rich predictive data. Why surplus? Because right from the start, these were more data than was required to improve products and services.
Pepsi's Number Fever campaign in the Philippines has probably gone down in history as one of the biggest marketing disasters in history, mainly because of a human error that led Pepsi to print more winning caps than they planned. The resulting chaos caused riots, civil unrest, and even deaths.
The late years of the 20th century marked the era of monopolies, a time of ruthless competition among corporate giants to dominate consumer markets. These companies used every tactic imaginable to defeat their rivals. Marketing had turned into a battlefield, one that spanned the entire globe, from Latin America to Africa, and from there to East Asia, including the Philippines. The Philippines had been a colony of the United States for years, and even after gaining independence, little changed. Repeated interference in the country's politics and culture amounted to indirect colonialism, a solution that suited Western corporations well. Major companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi saw opportunity. In the early 1990s, these two rivals turned the Philippines into a battleground. They did everything they could to bring each other down, although Coca-Cola was usually more successful. In 1992, Pepsi's marketers fired their last shot to defeat their competitor. They launched a promotional contest. Each bottle of Pepsi contained a number, and if someone found the winning number, they'd receive a cash prize. The campaign captured the attention of millions of poor Filipinos.
I won!
Look for the winning number in Sari Sari's first every day, off on TV, radio, newspapers. You could be a millionaire.
Pepsi sales skyrocketed. Coca-Cola stumbled, and the fever of the contest swept across the country. Pepsi became scarce. Some people bought dozens of bottles, not for daily consumption, but in hopes of winning. This continued until the moment of the draw. a tense moment that ended with the announcement of number 349. Everyone wanted to know who the winner was. Within minutes, it was revealed that a housewife had the winning number, but a strange problem arose. A bus driver also claimed to have the same number. Hours later, a tailor said he had it too. And it didn't stop there. The next day, thousands of people across the Philippines claimed they had number 349.
People were dancing in the street, celebrating. They thought their problems were over. They were millionaires. It's still not certain exactly how many winners there were of Lucky 349 bottle caps, but we know that Pepsi printed over 600,000 of them.
Pepsi quickly issued a statement. Company executives announced that the winning number had been printed not once, but thousands of times, meaning there would be no winner in the contest. People were furious. They had spent months investing time and money, and now, with a single statement, everything had been swept away. Those holding the winning number saw Pepsi's response as a major insult, one that demanded protest. What followed over the next few months resembled a crime drama. Protests outside Pepsi factories, clashes, political turmoil, official statements, and ultimately the decision by demonstrators to file lawsuit. The protesters accused Pepsi of colonial behavior, while Pepsi labeled them as agitators. Rumors spread that Pepsi executives had paid criminal groups to incite violence under the guise of protest. Several bombings, fatalities, and hundreds of arrests followed, all seemingly aimed at discrediting the protesters in the public eye. No one could believe that the security of an entire country and the lives of millions had been disrupted over a single mistaken number. Everyone knew Pepsi would never be held accountable for its actions. This was the nature of marketing campaigns: profit-driven, exploitative, and ultimately dismissive of reality. A century had passed since the invention of this profession, a profession that had infected the entire world with consumerism. The Pepsi incident was only the beginning.
Okay, look. So, it's the middle of the night. We're in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and look what we've got. See all this stuff? Look. Look. Hats, t-shirts,